I land at Heathrow in the morning, numb with tiredness, but my spirits lift when I see Oliver waiting in the crowd. He lives in a village named Malmesbury, 50 kilometres east of Bristol. He doesn't take me there immediately, because the first rule of jet lag, I'm to find after many flights between England and Australia, is never to sleep during the day. We drive to Castle Coombe, an exquisite medieval village through which a clear stream burbles. Outside a whitewashed pub, a lady sells small handmade bags. I pick up one tufted with brown fur and run my fingers over it. I like touching things, and I can tell what I'm looking for in my wardrobe by the feel of the fabric. My sensitivity to touch is related to my deafness. When the brain is deprived of information from one sense, it often compensates by processing input from another. This is known as cross-modal plasticity. There are a large number of anecdotal reports of people who have lost one of their senses and show an extraordinary ability with one or more of their remaining senses. The French writer Diderot, for example, described the famous case of a blind mathematician who could recognise fake from real coins by touching them. Research shows that some deaf people have enhanced motion detection, visual orienting, and attention in their peripheral vision. This makes sense, as people who sign need to focus on the movement of hands and faces. Others might need to pick up activity in the corner of their eye, such as a motorbike coming towards them, which they might not hear. "How about I buy that handbag for you, Jess?" Oliver asks. "A welcome to England present." "Yes." We take tea and scones in the manor house and wander through the immaculate gardens. In the pleasure of seeing Oliver again and the novelty of being in a new place, my thoughts of Alex recede. During the week at Oliver's, I struggle to keep warm. It's autumn and the air is damp. I walk through Malmesbury's narrow, cobbled streets until I reach its edge, where stone cottages are bordered by fields of thick, wet grass. I turn back and head for the abbey. In the graveyard, a headstone tells the story of a girl who was killed by a tiger in 1703. "It can't be true," I say to Oliver when he comes home from work. "It is. She was a barmaid at the White Lion pub. The tiger was in a circus that stopped by. She kept aggravating the tiger, so it got annoyed and killed her." I don't know whether to be amused or horrified. Then the week is over, and I catch the train to London, where I've arranged to live in a college for postgraduate students. The college's manager has put me into a room near the entrance of the building in case there's a fire and I don't hear the alarm and someone has to get me out. The room is a cell. It's one barred window opening to the brick wall and pipes of the adjacent building. I put down my suitcase, my happiness of the previous week draining like water down a plug hole.